Welcome to the Relationship Manifesto podcast series.
Welcome back to the Relationship Manifesto podcast series. At least I hope it's welcome back. You're not just a new listener, but if you are a new listener, a definite welcome. And that was a ramble for a start. Episode 40.
Already,
yeah, thank you. Right. Started. What a ramble. So the Relationship Manifesto podcast series. A bit of an update about the book. The ebook has been on Amazon for a little while now. Been some interesting emails flying around and a few nice compliments, including what's the cover all about. But we're not going to try and answer that just now. A little bit of frustration from my part as being the sort of engineer of this is that I'm still waiting to get an ISBN number sorted out so we can put it in iTunes. But it's on the way, and the light is at the end of the tunnel, and hopefully it's not a train coming the other way. So, this episode, Stephen, welcome.
Mm-hmm.
Just to check, folks, he is here.
I'm here, yeah. I'm still here. Thanks, Chris.
Stephen, one thing I want to say is after last week, I actually found last week's session a real sort of really refreshing because I think it's affected my vocabulary for now until the end of time because the term pleasure worker, I think it's a brilliant term.
It is, isn't it?
It takes away the stigma that the term sex worker brings with it.
Yeah.
It clarifies the fact that pleasure workers aren't necessarily sex workers.
That's right.
And I think that's a really healthy thing.
It is. It's so simple, isn't it? It's such a simple term and yet so effective. It illustrates and captures, it illustrates the diversity of sex work, sex workers, and also the capacity of that sex interaction for money to not necessarily be just about sex.
Yes.
Or even about sex, but it can be about intimacy and emotion and connection and friendship. There's all sorts of stuff going off. And that really does correspond with a lot of the research that's been done on sex work, prostitution. It's the pleasure aspect is central. Yeah, so, good term. And it'll be, I'm going to be bringing it up again in this talk over about Taiwan because there's plenty of pleasure to be had in Taiwan. It's a funny place, Taiwan. I mean, it's peculiar in that way because it's only a new country. We're talking about it came into existence about 1950 when Chiang Kai-shek's army of several tens of thousands left mainland China. Under having conflict with during the Communist Civil War, the Chinese Civil War, and went to Taiwan and took it over. And then from that point on, it became the Republic of China. So you've got Taiwan, the Republic of China, and that's what gets stamped on your passport when you go in. And yet you've got the People's Republic of China over the water. So which is the real China? And there's a brilliant YouTube take on this, which I can't just remember it, but it's which of these two places is the actual real China, and they're both real in their own way. But Taiwan, small, population about 23 million. Taipei is the main city, population 4 million. What's interesting about Taipei? Well, the first thing you see the Taipei. It's got the world's, it did have the world's biggest penis. Yeah, it did. It had the world's biggest penis.
We should clarify that the last week we were talking about Japan, and it was because Stephen had been on some jaunts to Japan and then Taiwan, and we said last week we talked today about Taiwan. So just a bit of clarification there.
Yeah.
But it did have the world's biggest. Are we talking about a sculpture? It must be a sculpture you're talking, not a real one.
I'm talking about 101 building.
Oh, okay.
Okay, because okay. I mean, I know you can't. You've seen 101 building. I mean, it's the first skyscraper to break the half kilometer height. It was the first record breaking.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was the first record breaking skyscraper of the 21st century. And up until 2010, last year, when Burj Khalifa got built in Dubai, building Taipei 101 was the world's tallest building. So for 6 years, it was the ultimate phallic symbol. And that is, these phallic symbols are going off all over the place.
And do the locals actually call it that? Because in Hong Kong, there's a building which used to be called Connaught Centre, and they changed the name to Jardine House, which has got lots of, all the windows are round. Mm. And they called it the building of 100 or 1,000.
Well, Taipei 101 building, it's called 101 building. That's what people refer to it as. Have you been in 101?
I haven't, because it was the last time I went to Taiwan. It wasn't built.
Oh yeah, it's quite something. But I do like to see it as a phallic symbol, because I think there's a lot of that going off. You know, it's Taiwan trying to make its mark, and it's not surprising, because I mean, Taiwan's formerly Formosa. It was occupied originally by the Portuguese. The Japanese took it over in 1895, and they were there till after the Second World War. The Americans came in for a spell, and then Chiang Kai-shek's army took it over, and now you've got Taiwan, which is ostensibly an independent country, though interestingly enough, it's not even recognised by the United Nations. Yes. So it's got this tension with China, and there's an election coming up at the moment in Taiwan, and really the big issue is there's only one political question: is do we have closer links with China, People's Republic of China, or do we keep trying to maintain our independence? On the other side, Taiwan's a very wealthy country. It's now about the 16th wealthiest country in the world, from pretty much zero at one point. And its economic base has grown phenomenally in the last few years. And in 2010, the GDP for Taiwan was $35,000, which is more than Finland, France and Japan. And it's one of the four Asian tigers, along with Hong Kong, Singapore and Korea, South Korea. So it's a very prosperous country. When I've been there, the things I've learned about it, you've got HTC mobile phones come out of there, the Evergreen shipping companies, the Taiwanese, Acer and MSI computers, Giant Bikes, Kingston USBs and Foxconn, the company that makes the Apple computers in China. They're all Taiwanese companies. Mm. So it's good. It's in that respect, it's economically very strong. But it's like many of these countries, it caught up in the Confucian globalization web. On one side, you've got this ancient Confucian ideology around gender and sexuality, which promotes family, communal being, you know, respect for elders, maintaining a certain traditional way of life, which doesn't allow much for gay sex, lesbian sex, lady boys and sex work and all the rest of it. But all that goes off, of course, but it goes off with certain contradictions and certain tensions, because globalization's hit Taiwan phenomenally. So if you want to see globalization actually impacted on Asia, I think Singapore, Hong Kong and Taiwan are the places to go. But, you know, people don't go to Taiwan for holiday. How many people actually visit Taiwan as a tourist? There's not many. It's not a big tourist destination. Though it is a fascinating place, and the reason why I've got connections with it is because of friends I've got there, and they've got friendships there because of my son, Gavin, my older son Gavin. He's been living in Taiwan full time now for about 4 years, and my second eldest son Jay went out there in November to also live full time. And he's now studying Mandarin at Taiwan University. But getting on to the sex thing. I mean, what something interesting happened in Taiwan when I was just towards the end of my last stay there, which was on the 7th of November, I flew out. And that on that day, after a big debate, years of discussion and debate and in Parliament, the Taiwanese eventually came to legalise sex work or pleasure work. They've got it in designated red light districts, but it's now legitimized. So how many sex or pleasure workers are there in Taiwan? Somewhere between 100 and 200,000. You can find them in Taipei, and you can find them in the other big cities like Taichung. Though I'll talk about Taichung later. But just to compare what's going on in terms with Taiwan and pleasure workers, prostitution on the statute books is legal now in South Korea, Singapore and Taiwan.
I didn't know it was legal in Singapore.
Yeah, it's legal in Singapore. Indonesia, it's legal in Jakarta. In Thailand, it's illegal, but accepted, promoted, even encouraged. You know, it's everywhere here. In the Philippines, it's illegal, but it's not considered a serious crime. And there are, you know, the sex work industry in Philippines is well established. In Hong Kong, it's legal, but only if you've got an entertainment visa, entertainment license on the premises where it's taking place. In China, it's illegal, but not serious. But then that not serious is qualifications, because I read today in the news, in the online newspaper, there was a woman executed in southern China this week. She was a madam running a whole series of prostitutes, female prostitutes in southern China, and she was prosecuted and executed for that. So you've got all these mixed, and we talked about Japan last week where coitus is illegal, but, you know.
Yes.
Strange, bizarre situation.
But officer, I was in love with her.
But I was in love with her, yeah. Yeah, that's right. So you've got Taiwan's tried to deal with this in a very adult way, and it's, I think it's probably made the right decision, which is to legalize it. But then, you know, different people have different views. A lot of the pleasure workers, they say, well, it might be good for our business, it might not. Nobody knows how it'll play out, and whether they can keep some control on it. Because one of the things I noticed when I was in Taichung, the second or third largest city in Taiwan, and about 100 kilometers south of Taipei, there's a certain gangster element. I was with some friends, we didn't go in the brothels, but we went past the brothels, and there were clearly the heavy looking guys stood outside, and the brothels were more nondiscreet.
Not the same Africans from
Japan. No, these were local guys. And there are a lot of Thais, Filipinos, Indians and Chinese actually working in the pleasure business in Taipei, in Taiwan now. So that's the other aspect of it. There's not probably fewer, by percentage terms, there's probably actually fewer Taiwanese women working in it than there are women from other parts of Southeast Asia. The other thing you've got in Taipei and Taichung, what we mentioned last week, these happy ending massage parlours. Well, some of them are quite exotic and well established. You've got swimming pools, saunas, jacuzzis, all the rest of it. Where men just go to relax. Sex is available if you want that, but it's not in all of them. But it's never far apart, never far if you from the scene. If you know where to look, but you'd have to be in the city a while to find it. I'll give you an example. When I was in Taichung, I was only in Taichung one night with friends. We went looking for where the sex district was, and it was not easy. We actually went in a taxi. The taxi driver thought he knew where it was, and then went somewhere, and apparently it had been cleaned up only the week before. The police had gone in,
yes,
cleared the girls out, and there were no girls. This was by the railway station.
So why am I not surprised?
Why are you not surprised at that? Yeah.
Actually, that's too good point, isn't it? It's if you're looking, taxi drivers are taxi usually driving. a good source, yeah. And by the railway
and
station.
By the railway station, yeah. So we were in this taxi, and the taxi driver then felt a bit embarrassed because he thought he knew where the sex district was in Taichung.
Yes.
It wasn't there. It had moved only a few days before. And then we did find it. And what it consisted of was a series of semi-lit alleys in a large block area with a few restaurants. And you went walking around there, and the girls were stood around.
Not leaning against the lampposts.
Some of them.
Don't tell me. With fishnet tights on. And,
yeah, well, and, a bit of that, yeah. Not entirely inaccurate. So you then, the girls are all there. You approach the girls, and then they take you to some residence, either their own residence or some short time.
Did they speak English?
Hotel. No. And that's one thing about Taiwan. There's very little English being spoken. It's not taught as a first language in all the schools. If you want to learn English as a young person, you've got to go to an international school. Or you can learn it at university, but it's not common. And you go in a taxi. I would not go in a taxi in Taipei without written instructions, ideally in Chinese.
Well, that's a good tip for all travellers. We're not a travel log, but when you're in a country that doesn't speak English, you know, whenever you leave, wherever you're sleeping, get the concierge or somebody there to write your destination and where you are, so you can get back again
in
the local language.
Somewhere like Taiwan, because you know it's difficult to communicate. Though I think when it comes to sex, you could probably make yourself understood. But if you're looking for the sex districts or massage parlors, but even so, it's not like Thailand, and it's much more closed country. Even though it's in globalization's impact on the big way, it is closed in this respect. The other thing they've got a lot of is the love motels. There's lots of that type of operation going on. And that's similar to Japan, because of young people can't afford their own apartment. They're living with parents. They need somewhere private. And again, it's not the tourists that's using them. It's the locals who are using them. Probably, and primarily, I would think, couples. What other aspects of Taiwan, just briefly? Well, it's got a great public transport system on par with Singapore and Hong Kong. The road system's excellent. New buildings going up all over the place. The police are strong. You know, you wouldn't drive on a lot of motorcycles and motorbikes in Taipei. You wouldn't drive without a helmet, absolutely. And they're well on you quickly, the police. Is there general corruption in Taiwan? Yeah, there was a politician called Shen Shui-ban, who was locked up for 20 years back in 2008, along with his wife. He was ex-president. So they're trying to fight it. Politics is ridden with it out here in Asia. And the other thing about Taiwan, it gets struck by earthquakes and typhoons every now and again. So if you are going, looking out to go to Taiwan, then, you know, pick and choose the time, place to go.
Yeah. Last week, can I ask you to compare something to last week? Last week, you were very exuberant about the fact that Japanese women were very feminine.
Mm.
Is it the same in Taiwan? Oh, is that that's the answer.
I prefer Taiwanese women to Japanese women.
After what you said last week, because last week you were very, very. Yeah.
Oh, no, I would. I would rather, if I was looking to settle in one place, if I wasn't going to live in Thailand, Taiwan would be where I'd go. Absolutely, I would bypass Cambodia, I'd bypass Malaysia, I'd certainly bypass Singapore. Hong Kong would attract me, but it's expensive. Taiwan, I would live in Taiwan because if I left Thailand, I wouldn't be taking my wife with me. The only reason I'd leave is we'd split up.
Yes.
But I would go to Taiwan because I've met a lot of interesting people there, male and female, who are well educated, interesting. If you get in a certain group of people in Taiwan, the more liberated, I think, open minded the Taiwanese.
So are you talking about the expat community or the Taiwanese community?
I'm talking about both. Certainly the Taiwanese community. The educated middle-class women, there's more of them probably in Taiwan than there are in Thailand. It's got a very good education system. In terms of attractiveness, I would look at Taiwanese ladies. The Japanese ladies are beautiful, and they've got this very essential femininity around them, the way they dress, the way they present themselves. But I think you'd need to be in Japan, in Tokyo, a while as a Westerner to sort of connect and get into relationships and get to meet people. Certainly the Westerners that I met in Tokyo and Japan, who have been there a while, all of them were married to Japanese women. But you go to Taiwan, you seem to see the same thing. You see guys from South America, North America, Europe, living and working in Taiwan. And invariably, they're linked up with Taiwanese women, if they're straight. So, but I would prefer Taiwan as the place to go. Economically, it's a better place to live. It's a lot less expensive than Tokyo. You can have a lot of fun if you know your way around. There's some great bars and clubs and restaurants, and it's an easy city to get about. But no, the women are quite special. Yeah, I like Taiwanese women.
It's interesting. I don't hear people talk about I'm going to go and retire in Taipei. It tends to be I hear a lot though. I'm going to work in Taipei.
Yeah, sure.
It's very much it's a bit like Hong Kong. You don't go to Hong Kong to retire. Generally, it's a place where Hong Kong's there. for one purpose, to make money.
I absolutely agree. I think that's been the way it has, that's been the tradition of Taiwan, or how Taiwan's developed in its relationship to expats, Westerners. The Western have gone out there to earn a living. And because of the growth in the technology market that Taiwan's got, there's a lot of opportunities out there. And people don't probably won't think of Taiwan as somewhere to retire. But I'd say to people, yeah, you consider it, because you've got an economy that's on par with Thailand. If you're straight or gay, the guys are good looking, the women are good looking. They're not as openly available as the Thai women, but they're very attractive. They're better educated, and if they are educated, they're likely to converse in English better. And it's a beautiful island. It's got a lot to offer. It's interesting, and you can get to so many places from Taiwan quite quickly. You've got Hong Kong, you've got Singapore, you've got all of China, you've got Japan, and of course you've got Thailand itself. So it's a hub is Taiwan, and it's increasingly becoming so. So you could live well, and that's somewhere I would seriously consider if I wasn't in Thailand.
Yes.
And the weather's not as good as Thailand, but it's certainly got a lot to offer. And if you're gay, what about the gay scene? Well, the gay scene out there is really strong. Taiwan is, Taipei, not many people know this, but Taipei held the first gay pride parade in Asia. First gay pride parade ever held in Asia was held in Taipei in 2003. And it attracted then about 10,000. And it's last year, 2010, apparently there were 30,000 on that parade in Taipei. It's now the biggest single gay pride event in Asia.
Wow, I didn't know that either.
Yeah. And that's interesting, isn't it? Because you've got this...
Some countries it's illegal to be gay, right? So
in some many countries it's illegal. It's a death sentence to be gay. And you know, interesting enough, you consider how open in terms of gay identity, if you like, and LGBT identities, open Thailand is, and yet back in 2010, I think it was, or 2009, they attempted a gay pride parade here in Chiang Mai, which got stopped by a lot of bad temple local men who attacked the parade.
Really?
That was in Chiang Mai, yes. Yeah. And M Plus, one of the organisations I know very well, based here in Chiang Mai, they helped to organise that first gay parade, and they were taken aback by the strength of feeling against it.
So
by
was
many
it, it cancelled?
Well, it went ahead, but it went ahead under sufferance, and there were people at risk, and it was a very upsetting situation.
Yes.
Now this year, 2011, they did another gay pride parade
in Chiang Mai.
Back in, I can't remember when it was, maybe April, and I took part in that along with my wife and stepdaughter. And that went through the centre around the night bazaar, and it was fine. There were no problems whatsoever. But I think the idiots stayed at home. Hopefully, well, they certainly did. I was on the parade, and I was walking, and I didn't.
Were these Westerners or Thais that were causing the trouble?
Oh, they were Thais.
They were Thais.
Thais. Yeah, there's a certain element in Thai society that very conservative, reactionary sees, you know, any sort of promotion of gay identity as being counter to how they want to present traditional Thai culture. So you've got that out here.
Yes.
And that's an example of how gay rights can be resisted in Thailand, which is seen as a gay paradise, and rightly or wrongly. You go to Taiwan, which is not seen as a gay paradise, where there are still very traditional values holding down people's ability to express themselves.
Yes.
In the sexual identity, but you've got the biggest gay pride parade in Asia, attracted 30,000 people last year.
Good job we're not drunk, because it's actually quite difficult to say
gay pride parade,
isn't it?
It's a mouthful.
Don't say that after a few.
No,
minutes.
Absolutely.
But that's I find that's quite encouraging that
it is.
At least they stay open minded, because that culture is not. Doesn't have a history of being open-minded.
There's still a lot of issues, and I've got to thank Catherine Chen again here, because Catherine's given me a lot of detail, a lot of information about how the gay scene's operating in Taiwan, and Taipei in particular. So thanks, Catherine, because a lot of what I'm going to say has come from research that she's done and her first-hand knowledge of it. One of the things about being gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgendered in Thailand, in Taiwan, is it's like Thailand where it's people will tolerate it, but they don't accept it. So a typical comment would be from parents, gays are okay, but I don't want one in my family. I don't mind gays being around, but I wouldn't want my son or daughter to be gay or lesbian. What would I do? I'd be ashamed. These sorts of comments are typical. So for many families, it's about holding up social face, social prestige, social reputation.
You're talking just Thailand, or are you talking about globally?
I'm talking particularly Taiwan now.
Oh, Taiwan.
Yeah.
Taiwan.
But the same thing does happen in Thailand.
Okay.
With middle classes. But this is particularly in Taiwan. So you've got a big gay sex district called Westgate City, part of Taipei. You won't see the transgender, transsexual individuals in numbers the way you do in Thailand, but though they are there. There's a strong gay scene, but again, it has to be careful how it expresses itself. Individuals have to be careful to what extent they can express themselves in everyday social interaction. There's still strong social codes being imposed on people. Largely, I think, and this is what people like Catherine told me, it's largely through the Confucian value system, which emphasizes keeping face, honoring the elders, being respectful, following traditional patterns of behavior, putting the family and community and country first over individual identity.
So no public displays of affection?
Certainly no public displays of affection between gays or between
even heterosexual.
Oh, even heterosexual.
You've commented yourself about, yeah, even in Thailand, walking, sure, around hand in hand is, sure, not... It's not a common,
yeah,
scene, is it?
It's not, and it's this place where East meets West. How Taiwan and other countries out here are going to cope with globalization and all the increase in demand for equal rights for women, for equal rights for gay, lesbian, transgender, transsexual individuals. Because it's out there now, it's very political. But you know, there was one comment came from Catherine, who said she talked to one of her gay friends and made this comment, and it's quite a sad comment really, but I think it's very poignant. You know, last week we talked about the liberated closet.
Yes.
And the idea that people can be liberated in their mind, but they then live in this closet, which is not so liberated. So they've got limited space for manoeuvre, for self-expression. And this is, closets can be particularly powerful in terms of family codes of behaviour in Asia, much more so than they are in the West. And there was Catherine quoted a gay friend of hers who had attended, who had just attended the funeral of his father. And the gay man said, only orphans can come out of the closet.
That's interesting,
isn't it?
It's logical, though, isn't it?
Yeah,
it makes sense.
Only the orphan can come out of,
yes,
the closet.
Yes.
And you see that a lot. And I'm also thinking of others. I'm thinking of Ali here as well. You know, when Ali Taylor, I think Ali had to move away from her family physically in order to come out of her,
yes,
closet. And we all get that. It's something that's been picked up on a few of the podcasts I've recorded, you know, the power of the family expectations. And they do impose a closet, but it's sad that only the orphan can come out.
Mm.
But you can see how that works. So these are part of the dynamics that's operating in Taiwan. It's very similar to Japan. But you've got a lot of other stereotypes, particularly around women. I'll give you an example of porn. You know, I don't know, one of the characters, anybody who watches straight porn, you see there's differences around the world in terms of how the porn's portrayed. Typically, for example, porn in the States, in the USA, will be, the women will be very active. Traditional porn that's coming out, mainstream porn in the States, out of Hollywood areas, San Francisco, the woman will be, She will be doing the fucking along with the guy, put it like that. Now, you come out to Asia and the roles get reversed. You see porn from Japan and it's very different. The women are being fucked. They're not partaking on an equal basis. And that's similar in Taiwan. It's as if the women can be allowed to express their sexuality, but in a passive way. They have to be passive. They can't be out and aggressive and enjoying it. They've got to be done to.
Yes.
They're not doing it themselves.
So this comes back to something you mentioned once before about the power game.
It's the men like to be seen as dominant. Asian men. I mean, I know we see that in the West as well, but it's particularly apparent in the way the porn's expressed here. You know, you see scenarios where the girl's got to be dressed up as a little schoolgirl.
Yes.
You know, and the teacher's having sex with a schoolgirl in the classroom, or she's there's bondage, or there's some guy working her with a dildo, or control. The man's in control. The woman's passive, starts being upset, but then ends up enjoying it. These patterns of pornography get operated on out here. They're illustrative of the larger sexual codes that are prevailing in the Asian societies, and this is very apparent in Taiwan. But it's ironic because that's not what's happening in real life. In real life, in Taiwan, you've got women asserting themselves sexually, being more expressive, more open, more demanding. There's a lot. Taiwan's very much at the interface of gender change. I'll give you an example of this. Even though Taiwan's largely off the map of most sociologists or researchers into gender sexuality, it's actually at the forefront of what's happening in Asia, is Taiwan, more so even than Singapore or Hong Kong. It's got one of the lowest birth rates in the world now, is Taiwan. It's less than one baby per woman. And at that rate, Taiwan can't replicate itself. So it's lower than...
This is a self-controlled thing rather than an enforced legal...
This is a self-controlled...
As in mainland China.
Yeah, it's not like mainland China. No, women in Taiwan can go off and multiply as much as they like, but they aren't doing. And this has been a big change in the last decade. So it's now got a lower birth rate than Singapore, Hong Kong, Macau, South Korea.
And the reason?
Well, we'll come on to that. Taiwan's got one of the highest divorce rates in industrialized Asia, and it's doubled in the last 15 years. It's now about 50%. Single women now make up 35% of the Taiwanese female population from the age of 30 to 40. So 35% of all Taiwanese women aged 30 to 40, they're single. And that number's doubled since 1980. You've got more women delaying marriage or not getting married at all. And you've got more women delaying having children. If they do have children, they're not having many. So we're seeing this pattern across Asia. The reasons are many, but it's certainly to do with women's heightened expectations of what a relationship's going to be about. They are moving out. They're expressing their independence and moving out of dysfunctional, unsatisfactory relationships where the guy is unfaithful or uncaring or ungenerous. In those situations, where in the past, the Chinese woman, the Oriental woman, the Asian woman would say, okay, I'll put up with it because it's my lot. I have no choice. Now she's saying, I'm not putting up with it. I'm going.
Yes.
I'd rather live on my own. I'm educated. I can live on my own. I can earn money. The women are in employment now in Taiwan. A lot of work. There's very low unemployment. A lot of women going through education system, MAs, PhDs. They've got women more independent lifestyles. There's more women cohabiting, not getting married. And there's more women also. The other interesting thing, which I haven't got data on this is more my subjective opinion, but I think there's more same-sex relationships occurring. I think there's more women engaging in same-sex. I won't call them lesbian relationships because I think lesbian identity is pretty fixed identity in most cases, particularly if it's the tomboy lesbian character. I don't think, in most cases, that type of woman's not going to engage with relationships with a man. The more feminine lesbian may well do.
So same-sex pleasure relationships?
I think same-sex pleasure relationships, yeah. Sex is part of it, but there's also an emotional connection, and I know that with some of my friends.
Companionship.
Yes. Where the women, along that border edge, the straight women, they've had relationships with men in the past, and the women probably in the 30s, 40s, and that. But they've got friends in the female group, and they can sense there's an attraction, there's an empathy.
Yes.
And these the women are not going to go off and get married or live together forevermore, but there's that interest, there's that curiosity, and it's a safe environment.
Yes, that's an important word, isn't it? The safe. We've talked about that in several podcasts before. It's being in your comfort zone.
And I think that's one of the things about having a same-sex relationship for many women. There's a certain empathy and understanding around what it means to be a woman, and they share that. And there is that physical curiosity as well. So rather than get into some unsatisfactory relationship with a guy, there's more same-sex relationships taking place with women. So you've got all these characteristics going off in Taiwan. Low birth rate, increased divorce, more single women, delays in marriage, or increased number of cohabitation. It's very much like the West, isn't it? It's very like, you know, you could say the same in New York, say the same in London.
Yes.
This is a worldwide phenomenon, and it's one of the things I'm picking up and discussing in the book, The Relationship Manifesto. It's a fascinating thing. But it's got a knock-on effect for the men. Well, what are the men going to do? Because the men, if they don't change, if the Taiwanese men don't change, where are they going to go and get their partners? Because they're not going to get them with the more advanced, educated, independent Taiwanese women. Where they'll go to Thailand, they'll go to Cambodia, they'll go to Vietnam, they'll go to the poorer areas of Southeast Asia, where the women will be looking for marriage out of economic necessity.
Yes.
And that's a trend. We've seen that trend taking place in Singapore. I've seen it here in Japan. Taiwan, with many Japanese men living out here in Thailand with Thais. Obviously, you see it with the Westerners. So the same thing is happening in Taiwan. You only start educate women, then you advance them. You advance, their aspirations change. Their aspirations get heightened. They start making rational decisions about and choice about who they're going to spend their life with. But the irony is, of course, it's like the Western women caught in this duality between wanting independence, being able to be independent, being able to express themselves sexually in a much freer way than their grandmothers or parents could ever do. But then they still want
Disneyland.
Absolutely. And that's the cut, isn't it? That's the tell point. Because they still want, they're still looking for this ideal marriage and happy ever after.
Yes.
And they feel guilty if they can't get it.
Yes.
And they feel inadequate. I think many women in Taiwan, as in other parts of Asia, they look at themselves and think, well, what's wrong with me if I can't find this perfect man who's going to look after me for the rest of my life, or I'm going to be with for the rest of my life on an equal relationship? And these perfect men aren't out there. There's very few. You know, there's very few, I think, there's very few Taiwanese men that I've come across are as enlightened as the new generation of Taiwanese women. The Taiwanese men are about three decades behind in the thinking, some even more than that. The Taiwanese women are moving on. Mm-hmm. Certainly those who are middle class educated. The Taiwanese older women will look at the new generation of women and wish I had that. I'd had that sense of freedom.
Can you tell which is which by how they dress?
Within Taiwan, it's difficult. I can't pick up the social cultures or the social categories by looking at the Taiwanese women, I have to say. If I go around one of the big department stores, you might see more expensively dressed Taiwanese women. But it's very difficult for me as a Westerner going in to spot it. I think there obviously are significant social divisions, as there are anywhere. But then again, I say it's got high employment basis, it's got low unemployment, there's a lot of work for people. One other thing I find interesting, there's a lot more, because Taiwan's becoming the last decade or so a very prosperous hotspot in Southeast Asia, you've got a lot more Thai women and Filipinos moving out there. So it's not
to work as domestic helpers.
As domestic helpers. I'm not so sure about the pleasure worker thing, though there is that element. Certainly a lot of Thais and Filipinos working the pleasure work industry. But they're also working other aspects of you know, legitimate work, the more accepted work in Taiwanese culture. Restaurants, office,
yes.
Hospitality, hotels, all the rest of it. Now, what I have seen when I've been to Taiwan is more... It's quite a number of Western men with Thai and Filipino partners. Mm. Though, again, there are a lot of Taiwanese women who are interested in relationships with Western men. But Western men don't come with the same cachet in Taiwan as they would in Thailand. By that, I mean, in Thailand, the Western men can be seen as walking ATMs.
Yes.
You know.
Automatic teller machines. Give me your money.
Yeah, give me your money. In Taiwan, that's not the same, because the Taiwanese women are not...
You think they're affluent already? Or?
They're already affluent, and they're not so functional. They're looking for something more than just money.
Yes.
If you're in a relationship with a Taiwanese woman, the first question she's not going to ask the first question is how much you're going to give me every month.
Yes.
Or will you look after me and my family?
Yes.
I'm not saying that's not there in part, but it's not as such a big thing as it is here in Thailand, where it's absolutely fundamental to most relationships between Western men and, mm. and Thai women. In Taiwan, the interaction between West and East in terms of sexual and gender relationships, and certainly long-term relationships, is much, much more bound around love, companionship, empathy, friendship, sexual compatibility, respect, equality. So all the terms and phrases and ideas that you would expect in the East, in the West. So when I first came to Thailand, first thing that struck me was you cannot have an equal relationship with a woman here in Thailand. It by equal I mean that you would get in the West. If I was in a relationship with someone in the West, in the UK, it would be very unusual for me to expect for me to be expected to be the male breadwinner, looking after that woman, and she's completely happy to be looked after, taken care of, and almost controlled by me. On those terms, in Thailand, that's the environment. You know, you look after your partner, you get married, you are the one that's bringing in the money. She may or may not work, but that's her choice. So there's this real discourse of taking care. In Taiwan, it's not there. It's more like the West.
Mm.
You don't have to take care of the Taiwanese woman. But then again, what you do have to do is engage with them on a more equal basis. And it's, in that respect, it's more Western.
And you'd still be caring for an equal anyway.
So. You'd be caring in a compassionate, in emotional way.
Yes.
But not necessarily being the financial protector in the traditional sense of the word.
Stephen, we're coming to the end of the time.
Okay.
But I want to ask you two questions. The second question, I want to ask you about betel nuts, whatever they are. But the first question is, I'm just curious. You've just painted a picture where mm-hmm. you've shown that the differences between the genders in Taiwan is quite a few years as far as who would you give a copy of the relationship manifesto to, the guys or the women?
I think I would give it to the women first, because I know that many of the women would recognize a lot of the points in the book, and they'd recognize themselves in the book. And then they would have to probably give that book then to the men, otherwise the men won't access it. Which gender should read it? That would be my choice. I give it to women first because I know they would access it and it would resonate with them. But the other point is, which gender would
needs it more?
Needs it more, yeah.
That's it. That's
it's the men.
Yeah. Okay.
The men need it more. Yeah.
Yeah.
The women need it in order to maybe get away from this trap of Disneyland, Walt Disneyland, happy ever after, lifelong love syndrome.
And realise it's not just them thinking that. There's actually a whole lot of people out there
that's right.
in the same boat.
Exactly. The men need it because they need to move forward into the 21st century. They're still mostly living in the 20th and some are still living in the 19th. Yeah. Okay, betel nuts.
Yeah, and that's spelled, you told me that, we talked about this, ladies and gents, earlier, because I asked him, what should I ask you about? And he said, ask me about betel nuts. And you spelled it B-E-T-E-L hyphen N-U-T-S.
Yeah, it's interesting. Every time you go somewhere out here, you come across some unique phenomena, or some phenomena that's unique to that country or culture. And betel nuts are unique to Taiwan. They may be in parts of China, I've not seen them, but certainly they're big around everywhere around Taiwan I've been. You have these little kiosks, and they're not much bigger than a bus shelter,
right.
for example, in the UK. And they've got bright lights, and they're open 24/7. And they've got these, mostly, not always, because there are guys working them as well, but you've got these young women in short skirts who look like pleasure workers. They really do. And they are, in a way, they are pleasure workers
in the bus station.
Yeah. But then you look, it's a stranger like me, you look, well, if the pleasure workers, well, where's the pleasure taking place? Because these are not, they're not big, there's nowhere to go. What is it? And I'd been going to Taiwan a couple of times, and then I started to realise.
Ladies and gentlemen, to find out the answer to this question, listen to the next podcast. No, I won't be that cruel, right?
What the betel nut is it's a stimulant. And you chew it, and you buy a bag for about the equivalent of £1, and you chew these nuts, and they bring out a red substance into the mouth, and they make you high, and they're a stimulant. They're a legal stimulant, and
so legal or illegal?
They are legal.
You're right. Right.
And they're all over the place. Lorry drivers chew them all the time. Taxi drivers chew them all the time.
To stay awake.
And but it's, what is it about the girls? Because the girls are part of the whole scene, you see. That these are not just over the counter, like you buy a newspaper.
Right.
There's an interaction going off where the girl sorts of pleasures the guy.
Flirting. Yes.
No sex. Pleasures through flirting and makes him feel good. He'll want to go back and buy more betel nuts And I've tried them. I did try them, and I got high on it. Yeah, I mean, it's quite a buzz. But then it goes, and then you've got to keep taking more, and apparently they're not very good for your health. But these betel nut kiosks are all over the place. And when you first go out there, you think, well, you're looking at the bright twinkling lights and the young girls and the short skirts and the low top, and you think, this is sex. But it's not.
And because... And purely for research reasons, you couldn't keep away, right?
Yeah, for research reasons, I couldn't keep away. So I was fascinated by it, and I was finding them all over. They're in the centre of Taipei, they're in the outer suburbs of Taipei, they're on the main roads going out of Taipei, they're in the countryside.
Right.
But the betel nut phenomenon. You should try it. Anybody going out there, just have a chew of these nuts. They're not particularly tasty, but they do give you a legal high. And
there are similar things in other Asian countries. In fact, I can remember, I've seen older Thai people eating something which really discolours their teeth.
It's probably the same thing.
I remember Nong, my wife's mother, eating this and chewing it, and it looks ugly.
It doesn't look nice. What was the other thing? The interesting thing is, it's so popular, this stuff, is that they've now started to cut down large parts of the Taiwanese countryside.
To grow the bushes, or whatever they are.
Yeah, they're like palm trees.
Right.
And they're all, you know, you come out of Taipei and you see them on the mountainside. There's rows and rows of these betel nuts palm trees being grown. But yeah, just an interesting little aside about Taiwan.
I've suddenly got this mental image of sort of betel nut chewing gum and betel nut breakfast cereal.
Yeah, they could probably market it.
You
know, put it on your cornflakes or something and go off in a high. But right. Yeah, it does give you a high. It's quite a potent stimulant. And the girls are attractive too. Yeah, they're nice.
Says he, as a by the way. Have we missed anything?
I think that's it. I would.
You had a great trip, didn't you? Both those, you know, Japan and Taiwan. Yeah. You came back really. Yeah. It was a bit of a sort of a buzz. Like having a shout. Yeah.
It was buzz, and it was nice to get away from Thailand for a while. I mean, I love Thailand, and it's, you know, my first choice to live. But I do like Taiwan, and I wouldn't have found out about Taiwan if it wasn't for my older son Gavin, who's now living there with his girlfriend Joy, in Sanshong, which is just outside Taipei. She's Taiwanese, yes. Yeah, and Joy, in many respects, is typical of the type of woman I've described. You know, divorced, no children, 30 in her early 30s, living with a Westerner in a very nice condo, both working, him and Joy. She's educated. She's got a circle of friends around her who are very similar age, background. Joy's family, heavily traditional, very religious, much more in the closet, and Joy's having to live both in the closet and,
yes,
and be out of it,
yes,
on a day to, and Joy travels all over the world for work. She goes to Germany, she goes to the UK, she goes to America, yeah, 3 or 4 times a year. She speaks English. Her mother and father don't speak any English, they just speak Chinese.
Yeah.
So this is the generation gap that's opened up in Asia. It was illustrated by people like Joy. It's illustrated like people like my friend Catherine Chen and a load of other people I know. Another lady, I'll give you an example. I'll just call her G. Went online. She's found a friend. I don't know if I mentioned her. Found an Italian friend. The Italian friend, male, came back to Taiwan. G and the Italian friend, now married, living in Taipei. G's 37, 38, Taiwanese woman, educated, speaks English. Been in relationships with Taiwanese guys, doesn't want it anymore. Met this Italian online, went to Rome on her own budget to meet him. And so lots of that.
Yes.
This is the generation of women that are now emerging in Southeast Asia.
Emancipated.
They're emancipated. They're going to become very powerful. They're already powerful in work. They're going to be the new leaders of Asia in the future, for sure. They're going to be in politics. They're already emerging into politics, not behind the men, but in front of the men, mm-hmm, leading. They're going to be in business and work. I mean, one of the most wealthiest companies in Taiwan is HTC Mobile Phones. It's owned by a woman. The women are the gender that's going to really
conquer the world.
Conquer it, and yeah, the men are going to have to look out.
Hey guys, he's making me sad again, right? He's bashing my ego down, and I'm resisting going back to this fact that we're a species of males, you know, heading for extinction.
Well, it's something I'm going to talk about this in the future. I had a very interesting conversation this week with a professor, Louis Goren, who's a Dutch endocrinologist. Who studied transsexuality.
I've no idea what that means.
Well, I probably not pronounce it right, but he's a Professor Goren is from the Netherlands. Worked a long time at Amsterdam University, then retired, living out here. And he's done loads of research, high-level academic research on transsexuality and transgender. And purely from his position as a medical scientist, as opposed to my position as a sociologist, we both come to the same conclusion, and that is men are the inferior species. Physically and now socially, they're becoming more redundant. You can back this up in any number of ways. He can back it up in terms of medical.
Okay, future podcast.
This is another one. Yeah,
future podcast. One short question is your son going to allow you to give a copy of the Relationship Manifesto to his girlfriend?
He already has it.
Oh, they already have it, right? Yeah, yeah. So okay, that would be interesting. So it doesn't have to be a Christmas present for them.
No.
And before this podcast, we discussed whether we should have a Christmas edition.
Yeah, I think we could do something with Santa.
So next week we should invite Santa and have a Christmas. Okay, let's think about that for next week, whether we have a Christmas edition of the Relationship Manifesto.
Well, I think it'll be rather satirical. We're not going to do. It's not going to be a traditional Christmas show, is it? It's going to be. It's going to be what?
Well, no, it'll be very interesting because, you know, I'm smiling now because all these weird images and old Christmas and Santa jokes are all in my head. But actually, there's a very serious side about relationships over Christmas.
Well,
and
there is,
I think if we do the programme next week, maybe we should, there will be a fun side. But I think there might be a really sort of, maybe a sad side to it as well.
Well, yeah, Christmas carries all sorts of expectations, and immediately then you're into a dangerous area because the expectations are not often met, and particularly in terms of love and relationships and family. But the fun side is, you know, what is Santa and, you know, how we can take a poke at Santa coming down the chimney.
Oh, poke at Santa coming down the chimney. And poor guy, he only comes once a year, so, you know, I couldn't resist, sorry. Okay, ladies and gents, thanks very much. That was episode 40 in the Relationship Manifesto podcast series. The blog is still alive and well at relationshipmanifesto.postgres.com, but just Google. Actually, I did a Google the other day for Relationship Manifesto, and over the past 6 months, because of all the online work, the footprint that we have now, for that term Relationship Manifesto is really big. You get a lot, it's been mentioned all over the place, so just Google it and you'll find links to where you can hear more, find out more, buy the book on Amazon, and hopefully soon buy the book on iTunes and in other places after that. So I hope you enjoyed that. Stephen, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you, Chris.
And I hope you bought me back a bag of beetle nuts, right? Or beetle nuts, whatever they however you pronounce it.
You stimulated enough.
Oh, thank you very much. Okay, ladies and gents, thanks very much. See you next week. Merry Christmas in advance.
This recording is part of a Relationship Manifesto podcast series with Chris Smith and Stephen Whitehead.